Egbert Ethelred Brown was born on July 11th, 1875, in Falmouth, Jamaica. He was one of those inquisitive kids, the kind who ask why in Sunday school to the horrified looks of their dogmatic teachers. And at a young age, it was clear that he was bound for ministry. But like many, he floundered around in a number of different fields until the call to ministry could no longer be contained. Now, as you might imagine, Jamaica's Christianity in the 1800s was Trinitarian. And it was on Easter Sunday that Egbert found Unitarianism. Listening to the service in his Episcopal church, he found that he could just no longer abide by what he called Trinitarian arithmetic. That very day, he recalls, he was visiting his uncle after church and saw a pamphlet on the table that said, "The Lord God is one God." Turns out that it was written by the American Unitarian William Ellery Channing, there on his uncle's table in Jamaica. Egbert devoured that pamphlet and was then led into his uncle's library, where he found many Unitarian books. When he finally decided to go to seminary, he had to choose between the African Methodist Episcopal denomination of his childhood and the Unitarians. He wrote to each, and he says that he addressed his letter to the Unitarians, and this is a quote, "to any Unitarian in New York City," and sent it off in the mail. And surprisingly, this is 1870, right? It ultimately landed on the desk of Franklin Southworth, who was the president of Meadville Lombard Seminary in Chicago. Now, I just got a letter returned to the Lafayette City Council because I put City Hall Lafayette, and they said insufficient address, so. Anyway, apparently the Postal Service worked better in the 1870s. Now, the AME Church, to whom Egbert had also sent a letter, Egbert says that they practically accepted him in their reply. They were eager to have him. Instead, Franklin Southworth, the president of Meadville Lombard, wrote back that the Meadville Lombard Seminary did not have a correspondence course, so Brown would have to come to the U.S. to study, and there were no Unitarian churches in America for colored people, and white Unitarians required a white minister, so he was unable to predict what the future would be after Egbert's seminary training. 1870s. And even after reading this, Brown could not in good conscience pursue a Trinitarian ministry that he did not believe in. So he left his wife and his family behind to be cared for by his own father and sailed for the United States. Brown had what he described a most agreeable 2 years at Meadville Lombard and was the first African American ordained into the Unitarian ministry in 1912. But his relationship with the American Unitarian Association was full of conflict. Knowing that he would not find a congregation in the United States, Brown went back to Jamaica to build a Unitarian church, funded in part by the American Unitarian Association. But that funding was not renewed after a visit to Jamaica by Reverend or Mr., I'm not sure, Hillary Bygrave, who worked for the UUA. And he gave a scathing report about the Unitarian ministry in Jamaica, clearly based on the cultural assumptions of Boston, with prejudices that included how dark-skinned Egbert Brown was in comparison to some other blacks in Jamaica, and how lighter-skinned blacks would probably not come to hear him because of that. Egbert's biographer, my colleague Mark Morrison Reed, writes, "The racial attitudes Brown encountered in the American Unitarian Association leadership posed very real obstacles for Brown. Their views on blacks were so limited that they could never seriously believe that Unitarianism could be grasped by them. And it's written all through this history of this time, this belief that black people somehow couldn't get it, which speaks to the Unitarian Universalism exceptionalism that is part of our, rooted in our history. But Brown, Egbert Brown, was persistent, if nothing else. When he heard of this loss of funding, they sent him an extra $100 to kind of ease the pain, and his wife told him to take that $100 and go back up to Boston and appeal, which he did. Tense, difficult, and racist conversations ensued, conversations that matched the cultural awareness of the times. Let's remember, we're in the early 1900s. And Brown returned to Jamaica with some funding, but he was told to go to Kingston, not Montego Bay, where he already was, and just start fresh. And within 2 years, the funding was pulled again. No one can build a congregation in 2 years. In 1920, with no ministry left in Jamaica, he came to the United States and started the Harlem Community Church, deeply Unitarian and not accepting money from the association. He did, however, repeatedly write to his colleagues and other Unitarian congregations asking for money. This did not gain him very many friends, and in fact, many or most ministers found him to be a bit of a pest by his repeated requests. And in 1925, a colleague wrote to the association asking that he be struck from the books as a minister. A battle ensued for a few years, and Brown was removed from ministerial fellowship and then reinstated a few years later when he appealed through the ACLU. For years, struggles of this sort continued as Brown built the Harlem Community Church, a congregation that had its own challenges between black Americans and the West Indian blacks, between socialists and communists, and with its Unitarian calling in general. But looking back, it was clear that Brown was never fully supported in his ministry, in large part because of the racism within the American Unitarian Association leadership. But human relationships are complex. Brown was also, by all accounts, a lousy administrator and a questionable manager of his personal and professional finances. It took him 3 times to get the correct paperwork to go to seminary. He actually came up to the United States the first time and didn't have the right documents to be admitted into the country, so he had to go back and wait another year. There was no financial accountability within the work in Jamaica, and his family was often on the brink of poverty. Prior to seminary, there was an incident in Jamaica where money was missing from, he was an accountant as well, and he was let go, and he said he was going to return the money. So, you know, it was complex, and we know that the individual stories all have complexities in them. But even with that, and with his persistence, he broke through the racism of his time as the first black man ordained to the Unitarian ministry, as a person who introduced Unitarianism to Jamaica, and the person who built the first black Unitarian congregation in the nation. This kind of struggle has been that way for all people of color within our denomination. You have to really want to be a Unitarian Universalist person of color to survive the hostility. In 1927, the Reverend Lewis Allen McGee, then an AME, American Methodist Episcopal minister, or African Methodist Episcopal minister, approached Unitarian President Curtis Reese and was told, if you want to be a Unitarian, you better bring your own church. And in 1958, when the Reverend David Eaton approached Dana Greeley, who was a UUA president, he was told, I'd love to have you, but we'll have trouble settling you. David Eaton had one of the most profoundly important ministries that this denomination has ever seen in Washington, D.C., and he was my first minister. And it was not until 1981 that an African-American woman, Yvonne Sion, was ordained. 1981. Hard to hear, isn't it? And for some, the distance of time may lessen the impact of this racist history, relegating it to bygone days. What's more difficult is to really acknowledge how pervasive and persistent racism and the white elitist culture that sustains it really are and continue to be, not only in our country, but in our denomination and in our individual congregations. Shifts have been slow, and our denomination and congregations reflect the waves of advancement, then conflict, then long periods of relative silence in the work of racial justice. You can see it in the country, right? We can see it in our denomination. These moments within the UUA tend to reflect in the same moments that they're happening in our country. So during the tumultuous time of the civil rights movement, the new UUA was formed, Unitarian Universalist Association, 1961. It was a merger between two congregations. And its first crisis arose around race in 1968, when the Black Caucus walked out of the General Assembly after promised funds were rescinded from them in tougher economic times. Super complex history that I can't go into in this moment. Very painful, and we backed away from it after that. And now again, with the reawakening of whites in this nation to the reality of racism and police violence against blacks, the UUA finds itself again engaged in exploring how deeply rooted racism is within our institution. You may know that in February of last year, the UUA entered into another crisis time around racial justice over the proposed hiring of a white man over a Latinx woman for a regional position in the UUA. The president of our denomination, the Reverend Peter Morales, resigned amidst the controversy, and three prominent white male leaders within our denomination followed suit shortly after. One of the challenges of that was the covenant was broken by those resignations, and lawsuits began to put up walls that made it difficult for restoration and conversation perhaps could have helped us through this in a different way. This hiring controversy occurred at a moment when racial tensions were already rising in the denomination, as they were rising in our nation. As ministers of color gathering called Finding My Way Home offered sharing of experiences for our ministers and religious professionals of color in a safe environment. Like the Black Lives Matter movement, this crisis also awakened white Unitarian Universalists to the challenges of being a person of color, especially a religious professional of color in this denomination. Sometimes, the hardest places to dismantle racism and white supremacy culture is within the liberal community. A Boulder Camera article just yesterday, entitled The Inclusion Illusion. Did anybody read it? Yeah. It looked at the lives of people of color in Boulder. It's going to be one of a series of three. And in some, people of color say they find it extremely difficult to live in Boulder. And even harder living in Boulder or being in Boulder than in the communities around Boulder. Painful. It turns out that, quote, being colorblind isn't enough to become a truly inclusive community. And it's naive to think that it is. It's not enough because it ignores the structures of institutional racism, the legacy of oppression, and our own indoctrination within it. And as hard as this may be among those of us who are white and full of good intention, this is not news to people of color. And people of color find it difficult to be part of our congregations as well because of the institutions that we don't even see, the ways that we operate. There was a whole report about that hiring process within the UUA that looked like business as usual, that created a system that opened the door to white people and white men in particular more than people of color. It just did. And it's terribly painful. Following the hiring controversy, the UUA Commission on Institutional Change was formed. And in their first report on racism within the UUA, they wrote this about the experience of people of color who are religious professionals within the UUA now. As a result of the aggressions they experience as part of the Unitarian Universalist culture, which include but are not limited to questions about their qualifications, comments that they were only hired as tokens, regular challenges to their authority, culturally uninformed comments or articulated racial slurs. Religious professionals of color are often in need of treatment for traumatic impact of this cumulative experience. I have talked to my colleagues about this and heard their stories, people I know and love. But I don't think I've heard enough of them, really. In her book, Becoming Wise, Krista Tippett, the renowned interviewer on the podcast On Being, and a white woman, writes this: "I can disagree with your opinion, it turns out, but I can't disagree with your experience. I've been pondering this ever since I read it because I was really drawn to it at first. But I do believe that hearing people's stories, this is really an important point too. I have come to think that while you may not be able to disagree with someone's perceptions, it sure is easy to dismiss them if they don't match up with your mental map of how the world is supposed to be. And so when we are people, those of us who find ourselves as people in the privileged position need to hear story after story after story to recognize the pattern of behavior and live with our discomfort of it. If you allow yourself to experience the discomfort of hearing story after story, they get harder to dismiss. You can go in and mess around with the details of any particular story. You could look at Egbert Brown and say, oh, but he did this, and he did that, and he did this. But story after story after story, you cannot dismiss that. If you want to be a rational thinking human being. This year, the UUA Common Read was a book called Centering, Navigating Race, Authenticity, and Power in Ministry. It was edited by my colleague, Mita Ramana. In it are story after story and great analysis of how racism impacts the lives of Unitarian Universalists and creates barriers to living out our deepest values. I've been moved to tears reading this book and recognizing how far short of our ideals we are living. This is uncomfortable stuff, really uncomfortable. And part of what keeps white supremacy culture in place is white people's unwillingness to stay in the discomfort long enough to be transformed by it. Reverend Sophia Betancourt, one of the three ministers of color to take over the UUA presidency after Peter Morales resigned last year, wrote this about how UUs justify silencing the work of building the beloved community. There is a fear that we will create some tiny place of discomfort, some memory of earlier pain, some small act of lack of inclusion that is used to justify massive lack of inclusion. We are extremely limited by that fear. How can we as religious leaders start to undermine the notion that it is okay for a personal small amount of discomfort to silence an entire tradition, an entire people, an entire faith perspective in our congregations? Wow. I've been caught up in that fear time and time again. And unless we begin to dismantle that, we'll be stuck. That fear has been labeled by scholars as white fragility. The invitation, no, the imperative to the majority white community within Unitarian Universalism is to really listen to the voices on the margins, historic and contemporary, voices that share the pain of racism, to honor the validity of those experiences, to pay attention to the discomfort that brings to us, and to do the personal work to move through the reactivity, denial, and rationalization that arises within us. To put that discomfort I have as a white person, in context with the pain of being chronically undervalued in a religious tradition that espouses the inherent worth and dignity of all persons. Our religious forebears, Egbert Ethelred Brown, Francis Ellen Watkins Harper, Lewis McGee, and the like, saw the great potential of this religious tradition and had the perseverance to stick with the pain of the gap between our ideals and their lived experience. May we, in this generation, be a part of lessening that gap. May it be so.